This is an interview with Roger Martin at the Oregon Historical Society. The interviewer is Clark Hansen. The date is 11-10-95, and this is tape 12, side 1. Did you have something to add to what you were just saying before we...
Well, the individual campaign speeches and so forth, I've forgotten a lot of it. I was running on a free enterprise, less government platform, and I'm sure I embellished that in any way I could.
Mm-hmm. The Willamette Week, I don't mm-hmm. know how fond you are of Willamette Week, but...
Well, I'm one of those people that the Willamette Week alternately slapped, spanked, and applauded, and I think they endorsed me for the governor's race, and I'm not sure why.
Well, they had some perceptions that they had, and I just want to pass them by you, mm-hmm. see what your reviews of this is. The first one is, quote, since his first election to the House in 1967, Martin has gradually become known as an aggressive, effective organizer of conservative interests. Martin's voting record last session is typical. He supported the grass seed growers in the fight against stricter field burning legislation. House Bill 3333, which would have speeded up the siting of nuclear power plants. A minority report to the Senate Land Use Bill, Senate Bill 570, that would have loosened the ties between local jurisdictions and the LCDC, and Regressive Inheritance Tax Bill, HB 2059.
My great achievements. 2059 was, and this gets us back to the 77 session, but it was one of the all-time legislative tricks that I pulled, or maneuvers that I'm most proud of. It was an inheritance bill that would have treated women equally with men, and it got out of the House. We finally got it out of the House, and it was a horrible situation where if the man died before the woman in a marriage and she inherited his funds, she had to pay a higher tax than if she had died and he didn't inherit the money, which is absurd. So we sent a bill over to the House, to the Senate, that made that equal. It got to the Senate, and Bob Smith said to me, Roger, I've got the votes in this committee, if you can believe it, to repeal the whole inheritance tax. And he had convinced Betty Brown, who was a state senator from Eugene, and a couple other Democrats in the committee to support him. Now, there were half a dozen Republicans in the Senate, so it had to be a bipartisan effort. Anyway, they passed the law, they passed the bill to repeal the inheritance tax and sent it back to the House for concurrence. Of course, the House has to concur in the Senate amendments. And the chairman of the committee, and I think it was Earl Blumenauer, I'm not sure, chairman of the Revenue Committee, was all set to stand up under propositions and motions and make a motion to send it to committee. But I, was as minority leader, could usually get the speaker's attention. I stood up on the floor of the House and made a motion that we, and he thought, Phil Lang thought I was going to make a motion to call it for a caucus, time out, or a recess for a caucus. Instead, I made a motion to concur in the Senate amendments and repass the House bill. And we had the votes on the floor to do it. We would have never been able to do it in committee, but we had the votes on the floor. And they were forced to vote, and it passed. And we passed the repeal of the inheritance tax. And eventually it gets to the governor, and somehow a bunch of people convinced the governor that it was good policy, and he signed the bill or let it go into law without vetoing it. So we repealed the Oregon Inheritance Tax, which I think is one of the most abhorrent taxes that exists, literally took away the family business or the farm or the homes of a lot of people, because if somebody owned a farm someplace, had net worth of $750,000 and all of the values in the farm, the only way you're going to pay a huge tax on it is to sell the farm in order to pay the tax, and it happened repeatedly in Oregon. So the Willamette Week thought it was regressive. I just totally disagree with it. I think it was a good policy move, and it's put us tax-wise in an advantageous position ever since.
They had another interesting perception. It said, Martin is in many ways Atiyah's antithesis, flashy, outspoken, and a bit of a hustler. The word we hear most often to describe Atiyah is gentleman. With Martin, it's fighter.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's correct. I mean, at age 43, I had honed my debating skills and so forth, and kind of like being a fighter.
When you look back over your campaign, do you think you would have done anything differently if you had to do it over again?
Oh, not really. I mean, sure if we could have figured out a way to talk McCall out of every filing, and that I don't think was possible. We might have, I really can't see, and we should have spent more time in the metropolitan area, should have more organized better. If we'd had the kind of organization in Washington and Clackamas counties that we had in Josephine and Klamath counties, we would have been a real factor in the race. Mm-hmm. But I was coming from a real long shot position. I think I, you know, had I had the wherewithal and so forth to stay around and run again sometime down the line, I might have been able to do better. But as it turns out, I went into the lobbying business after that, and I've been very happy to be there and enjoyed it very much. Once you get out of elective office, you suddenly take a deep breath and enjoy the roses and the sunsets and think, why did I ever do that before? I mean, campaigning is one of the most torturous kind of experiences. Once you've done it, and I ran for almost 20 years, when you finally stop, you realize, yeah, I get to go to the fall of 1978, I saw my first Oregon-Washington football game in Seattle. Because ever since I've been in politics, the Oregon-Washington game was played the year of the election in Seattle, and I never went to the games because it was always right around election time. I was out knocking on doors or campaigning in some way. Yeah. That for the first time I got to go to a game, I thought, hey, this is kind of interesting and fun things to do.
You knew that this would be the end of your legislative career.
No, well, yeah, I knew it was going to be the end of my legislative career because filing for governor precluded my running for the House again. And the Senate seat, I forget what the election cycle was, but it was 2 years off before the Senate seat I lived in was open again. Joyce Cohen ran and won my House seat that year, and I didn't have any, and I went into the lobbying business. So once I got into that, I was at that point in my life. Shortly thereafter, I got a divorce from my wife, who I was married to during the campaign. I went through that trauma. Kids were starting to college. I had to work real hard to pay my debts, including child support, alimony.
That was Janet.
Yeah, Janet. And it just precluded me from being active, running for office in the next 8 or 9 years. By that time, I remarried and had another life. And I still have an ambition way, way back in the back of my mind. I want to go back to the House of Representatives in the year 2000 and something and be the old curmudgeon standing in the back saying, I was here in 1967. I remember how it was in the old days.
Well, you can do just like Tom Hartung did.
Yeah. Tom and I were elected at the same time in 1966.
And he's in there now.
Yeah, he's in there now.
Well, how did you feel upon leaving the legislature? I mean, how were you looking back on all these years?
Probably I had a bit of nostalgia, but I was back that summer. I mean, I'm out of, first of all, here's the sequence. I lose the race in May of 1978, and immediately by July, there is a ballot measure. The first 1.5% limitation attempt is on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And I gathered with the vast group of people that opposed it and said I would like to be involved in this campaign, and I became the campaign manager and operative that ran the campaign to defeat the 1.5% limitation. That kept me very active and, you know, and doing something, kept me right in politics. And at that time, the 1.5% limitation had no legislative support. It was a groundswell kind of thing from mm-hmm. a certain element of the population, but politicians weren't in favor of it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't offend any of the elected politicians I had to deal with. And that summer, opportunity came along. United Grocers, who had their in-house lobbyist on a payroll for many years, changed presidents. New man was hired from back east, and I contacted him, and it coincided with the fact that their lobbyist was retiring from the company. Got to that age. I contacted the new president and said, hey, I really think you'd be better off if you had a contract lobbyist mm-hmm. who was down there all the time rather than an employee who had a lot of other functions and once in a while got to Salem. He agreed and hired me, or agreed that he would hire me after my legislative term was up. I couldn't take a job until after I was through with the legislative term, which expired in January the following year. And also I was approached by Dick Feeney, who had just become the lobbyist for TriMet, saying that they were going to form an Oregon Transit Association, and would I be interested in being the executive secretary of that, which was in essence a lobby plus a government relations job. So I had those two functions lined up, and I just kind of gravitated into the lobby business, which kept me in Salem, kept me involved in the legislative process. I just didn't have to run for office, and I've always viewed it as, hey, best of two worlds. I'm on the for-profit side of politics. I get paid for being in Salem a lot better than legislators get paid, and I don't have to run for office. So I've been there ever since.
The paper said that you were also exploring a newsletter, doing a newsletter about governmental activities and citizenship seminars and other educational programs for employees of businesses.
Those are all the kind of ideas that people just out of office come up with, and then you realize that nobody's really interested in a newsletter about what's going on in Salem. And the seminars, you'd probably get five people interested or five companies, and after that you'd run out of people. So none of those ideas panned out.
Well, looking back on your relationship with the Republican Party, how do you see that on the different levels, you know, locally, in the state? Were you involved at all nationally?
I was involved to some extent nationally as a member of the NCSL, National Conference on State Legislatures, that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
I got to meet a number of Republican legislative leaders, and we formed a National Republican Legislators Conference. And the purpose of which was to try to, you know, organize some kind of a cohesive relationship with the federal, with the, you know, the Republican National Committee, with the committee, and President Gerald Ford was the president at the time we were doing this. We ended up having a big meeting in San Diego, California, and Republican legislators came from all over the country to it. President Ford flew in. I guess it was in Los Angeles, now that I think of it. President Ford flew in, met with us, talked to us, shared ideas and so forth. Didn't last very long. I mean, those things are, depends. If he'd stayed in office, he didn't. He loses his election, and
right.
he is not in office any longer. So that kind of fell apart. I was always on good relationships with congressmen early in my career. I helped Wendell Wyatt get elected to Congress, and Wendell, I think I mentioned a long time ago earlier, Wendell always envisioned that when he decided to get out of Congress that I'd be the natural one to run for his seat, because at the time my district was in the first congressional district. That got shot in the ear when he had to resign because of Watergate, and the timing wasn't right.
Right.
Coin jumped in, got elected, and I didn't run. Those in politics, it's a lot of it is perfect is timing. If you're in the right place at the right time, you can take advantage of things. Witness what's happened to two of the Republican congressmen right now in Congress, Jim Bunn and what's his name from Eastern?
Wes Cooley.
Yeah, Wes Cooley. Nobody in their wildest dreams would have expected 4 years ago when Wes Cooley was first running for the Senate that, number one, he'd even win the state Senate race, and now he's a U.S. congressman.
Yeah.
Just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Do you think Bob Smith has regrets about having backed out of, retired from the Congress at that point?
No, Bob is enjoying what he's doing. Bob spent 12 years in Congress, and my time's up. His one regret was he didn't get to be there in the majority.
Right.
He would have loved to have been in the majority.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, that timing. To some extent, but he's moved back to Oregon. He's beautiful home in Medford. He's enjoying his kids. He's got married kids now, grandkids on the way. He wants to do all that. And he's a big enough person to take that step into retirement and enjoy it.
When you look back at the Republicans who've represented us in Congress in your lifetime,
mm-hmm.
who do you look upon as being the most...
Stellars, well...
Yeah, the most exemplary.
I would rank the finest congressman I think that I experienced. It would be a toss-up, but I'd have to toss it to Wendell Wyatt, who served during the 60s and early 70s, who I thought was just an outstanding congressman, and developed instantly into a leadership kind of a guy. Bring home the bacon, served on the Interior Committee, became very close friends with the congresswoman from Southwest Washington who chaired the committee, and he was her favorite person, and literally he got whatever he wanted for his congressional district, which was the kind of thing you want out of a congressman.
Why couldn't he have distanced himself from Nixon during the Watergate?
Oh, he was Nixon's campaign manager in Oregon, and he got caught up in the thing that started off where they sent cash out. This is right at the change when old rules are changing into the more open, all reportable kind of campaign stuff. All kinds of things had gone on in previous campaigns, both Democratic and Republican campaigns. It was not just Republicans that did this. But somebody foolishly, Mitchell, who was the former Attorney General.
John Mitchell
sent out a couple of $1,000 to put it in an envelope, keep it in a safe, and pay for this expense or that expense. And it became known during the investigation, after Watergate. I mean, after the election, everything else, that became known, and Wendell was caught in the middle of it. Jack Faust defended him, got him off without any, he resigned, and that was his punishment. And then Wendell went on to come back to Oregon to quite a career in practice of law here in Oregon. The other congressman would be Bob Smith, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. My kind of guy, down-to-earth, hard-headed Eastern Oregon rancher, heart of gold, but a tough mind, and knew how to get things done, and was a very effective congressman. Mm-hmm. And then the third person, of course, is Mark Hatfield, who I've mm-hmm. always liked. Mark and I don't share all of the same views. I probably was an enthusiastic supporter of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. He was always opposed to it. In the long run, he was right. And I've told him that. I've said I've given up criticizing you for doing something. Mm-hmm. Most recently, the balanced budget amendment, which I disagreed with, because I said usually you end up being right in the long run. I think Mark Hatfield is the epitome of integrity and honesty and success in politics. He's the most successful politician, I think, in the history of the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. First elected in 1950, and here we are in 1995, and he's probably about to retire and never lost a race. Pretty hard to go undefeated over a 40-plus year career in politics.
Yeah. Do you think he'll retire?
I think probably in the next couple of weeks he's going to retire.
Anybody else that you...
Well, I met a lot of other interesting people. I mean, knowing Wendell Wyatt was just a riot. A couple of things Wyatt did to... this is just kind of rambling. I went to Washington, D.C. on some legislative trip, and Wendell says, we're going to have dinner tonight, but first I got to go over to this Republican conference that we're having. And it turned out it was the joint House-Senate conference on how you get more Republicans elected to Congress. And I walk into the room, and he introduces me as Representative Roger Martin, leaving the impression with half these people I was a newly elected congressman and a state representative.
Did you do that intentionally?
Oh, on purpose. I mean, he had this wicked sense of humor. And so I met the senators and congressmen. They were all welcoming me. And then he asked me to sit in the outside office. And they realized I was just a guy from Oregon. He thought it was a big joke. I liked it. Another time I was in his office and the White House called. I think I mentioned this earlier. And the president, Nixon at the time, was going to be out in Oregon to open the one of the dams on the Columbia River, dedicated dam. And the speechwriter for the president saying, what are the current issues? And he said, I don't know, but I got a Republican here from Oregon that knows a lot here. Talk to him. And he threw me the phone. I'm on the phone talking to the White House. And the guy says, okay, what are the current issues? And I ticked off three or four issues that were current at the time. And sure enough, they were all in the president's speech that weekend. Well, that's pretty heady stuff when you're 37, 36 years old, and you know, you're making your big trip to the nation's capital. He did those kind of things. I think being around Mark Hatfield in his career in the U.S. Senate was marvelous to watch. I mean, he is one of the true champions of civil rights and justice, and he's, you know, the Lincoln kind of Republican that I've always admired. Mm-hmm. Watched him assume the power that he has and how he handles it. Mm-hmm. Good examples.
How well do you think Attia did in his two-year terms as governor?
Well, I think Vic Attia, as it turns out, was a very good governor. Vic went through some very tough times. Vic is the last governor who really got to Salem, went to the governor's office, and occupied the office and did all the functions that are on the books for the governor to do. Now, that doesn't necessarily get you lots of headlines, but one of the functions in Oregon's government is to run the executive branch of government, which is about 45,000 employees. Yeah. And a myriad of boards and commissions. He was on top of all of that stuff.
He was a real hands-on governor.
Oh, real hands-on. And you talk to any administrators in government, and they liked that. They liked the fact that he'd call a weekly conference in his conference room of all the heads of state government to coordinate things, and he'd be there at every one of these. He'd run the show. Now it's some staff person that runs it, and the people go occasionally and so forth. his immediate successor, Neil Goldschmidt, who's got a thousand great ideas and so forth, couldn't stand being in the office all the time. I mean, it just drove Neil nuts. And when his staff person would sit down with a list of names for appointments, she knew, and she told me this, that she could get two or three, and he'd walk out of the room and go somewhere else because he got bored with it. Vic would sit there for 3 hours as his staff person went through two or three dozen appointments, carefully examine all of them, and make his recommendations. Moron.
Yes.
Now, just to close on it, Tia, that we went through all the troubled times of the late, the early 1980s when money was very short, had to cut back on state spending, repeatedly meeting in special sessions, and Vic handled with, I thought, great talent and aplomb, and met with the legislative leaders, worked things out, and Oregon was under a steady hand at the time. Mm-hmm. He ended, recognized as a man of high integrity and good leadership at the state level. You mentioned, I mentioned some Republican legislators. I did have the opportunity early in my career to meet Wayne Morris, who I got a big kick out of. I didn't know the man very well. He was by this time a Democrat, but I went back to talk to him about some business things, perhaps even before I got elected, and found him to be terribly interesting and a horse trader. Glenn Jackson, who was the longtime chairman of the Transportation Commission, or the chief of the Highway Commission, would go back to see Morris and always would trade with him. Go back and buy a bull. Morris raised bulls.
Oh, that's right.
I
heard that.
And Glenn Jackson had a ranch, and Glenn Jackson's trick was to walk back and say, "Well, Wayne, what do you got going?" And Wayne Morris had to explain he's got this bull or that bull. And Glenn Jackson would buy the bull. Then the conversation would start about, "What do you want, Glenn? What can I help you with?" And always whatever Glenn wanted. After he bought the bull, he got whatever he wanted. And for Glenn Jackson, who was fairly well off of it, one more bull didn't hurt his overall operation, but it certainly helped him get the state or PPNL's bidding done at the time. I also got to know both Edith Green and Al Ullman. Ullman I found fascinating. I think I mentioned early in my career, I think my second term, we went back to Washington, D.C., just after the Nixon administration to come in, and got in the middle of a pissing match between Governor Tom McCall and Mark Hatfield. And I happened to be, it was a congressional luncheon in Washington with the governor there and legislative leaders from both Oregon houses, House and Senate, and all of our congressional delegation. And Hatfield and McCall got after each other, and I was sitting next to Al Ullman, and he was just chuckling under his breath about it. He loved it. There's two Republicans just getting in a match in front of all the rest of the delegation. And I said, "You're a mean soul." He says, "I just can't stand it. I just like the CEO was."
What was the argument about? Do you recall anything about it?
I can't remember. I mean, they could get in an argument about something important like the Vietnam War or something very unimportant. But whatever it was just it was like oil and water. They never got along. And it was usually McCall that picked the fight and then came out the worst for it, although I'm sure Mark Hatfield wasn't very happy to be involved in this kind of argument in front of people. He does not do public displays of temper in front of anybody.
Right.
I also got to know Edith Green, who I had a tremendous amount of respect for. Edith Green was a classic, competent congresswoman. Went to Congress after beating Tom McCall back in the 50s, but became more moderate as she served, and she and Wendell Wyatt had a lasting relationship, and in fact they co-chaired committees after they got out, worked on campaigns together, and had a building name for themselves and all those kind of things. But Edith Green was classic, a very bright, competent woman who just kind of went through it all on an even keel, and boy, nobody ever took her on because she could hold her own in any group.
Really?
I also got to know Bob Duncan a little bit when he was and tried to get myself involved in his final election campaign when he lost to Ron Wyden. I just thought that Bob was a down-to-earth kind of a guy, a crackerjack kind of a guy. He and Wendell Wyatt were very close friends in Congress, very close friends. I remember standing in the back of the House of Representatives At that time, Wendell's out, Bob Duncan's still in, and we're standing in the back of the house watching something going on, and Wendell could go on the floor as a congressman, or a former congressman, and somehow they edged me out just in the back. I'm staying there. And just at that time, I got to get the names right. The congressman from Southern Oregon has been gone for about 10 years.
Jim Weaver.
Jim Weaver goes on the floor, and then congressman, now governor of Washington.
Who's the Scoop pre- Jackson?
No. The present governor of Washington.
Evans, no. Mike Lowry.
Anyway, get the name straight. Mike Lowry and Weaver greet each other, and I think both of them are classic horses' asses. They greet themselves, big, loud voices. Oh, how you doing? And big arms around each other in the middle of this, you know, making a big commotion. And Duncan turned to Wendell and I and said, those are the two biggest horses' asses in Congress. Both members of his party, but both these loudmouth guys that didn't have, in my opinion, a lot to offer. Interestingly, although I'd served with Les Aucoin in the House of Representatives, I never had a very good relation, never a very close relationship. He was kind of aloof. I think he may have always viewed me as a potential opponent, so he didn't let his hair down and didn't talk to me very much. The business leaders at the time, I've mentioned Glenn Jackson, who was, one of a kind. We haven't found one since. We've been searching for 15 years for another Glenn Jackson who'd step up and command the business community to unify to do something. People like Don Frisbee and NATO, others have come along. Some have attempted, some haven't, but it's never been the same. Mm-hmm. There's just, I don't think there'll ever be another Glenn Jackson, a dynamic kind of a guy that can really get things done. Mm-hmm. Some of the legislators I've talked about, I think a number of legislators that I think were prominent. The ones that, looking back, that I think are just outstanding former members of the legislature on the Republican side would be people like Tony Ituri from Ontario, Oregon, who I just think the world of, one of the brightest people I ever knew. Very effective. Great sense of humor, could pull your leg until it almost fell off. He was so clever doing things like that. Dave Frommeyer, who went on eventually to become the president of the University of Oregon. Bob Smith, who went on to Congress. Tony Meeker, who was the state treasurer for a while, but was unable to extend his career into Congress. Now, those are just names that come to mind.
When you look back on your years in the legislature, you know, there's this ideal, I don't know whether it exists in other states, but it's the citizen legislator.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think of that ideal? And
I think the citizen legislature is a great ideal and one we ought to stick to. I still think that the biannual legislative sessions are adequate for the state of Oregon. And I know we get poo-pooed by other states who meet annually, and I get asked sometimes by people I consider to be very intelligent citizens, well, how can you possibly get the business done in the state of Oregon if you only meet once every 2 years? Well, the legislative function is to pass laws, not to run state government. The mm-hmm. state government is run by the executive branch of government. The more often legislators are in Salem, or the more often the Congress is in session, which is almost perpetually, the more they think they can run government, and they try to. And I think that's a mistake. I think legislators ought to set the broad pattern for policy and let somebody else run it. And I don't think that there's anything really that badly wrong that requires the legislature to meet more than every 2 years. And if they met more often than every 2 years, we'd have more full-time staff. And staffers are the ones that dream up all of these ideas of how government can fix something that probably government has no business trying to fix. And, you know, before long we'll have somebody trying to fix the weather in Oregon so the sun shines more often by a legislative act, and you just can't do it.
Do you think that the ideal of citizen legislator is Has it changed?
Well, it's changed, and it's never been exactly. There have been citizen legislators. There have been the Tony Atturis and the Greg Waldens in state government who have a private job back home and who want to be home with their family as much as possible, but are willing to come and serve. And then there have been a lot of people whose occupations, and often it's public employees, teachers, firemen, college professors, who go to Salem, and their bosses see that as a great deal.